This is the Freshman 15.
This is Daniel Long, and Dick Laurent is dead.
And this is Jeremy Bear, and if you want to know who killed Laura Palmer, here's a clue for you.
It helps who watched the whole series backwards.
Should we get started?
Yeah, let's do it.
There's a baby. It's at the hospital.
Mom!
And you're the father.
That's impossible. It's only been...
Mother, they're still not sure it is a baby.
It's premature, but there's a baby. After the two of you are married, which should be very soon, you can pick the baby up.
You don't mind, do you, Henry? I mean, about getting married?
No.
So, Daniel, I was wondering if I could take a trip down memory lane for
okay,
a second.
Okay, where are you taking me?
Do I do that too much, by the way? Do
Wait, go down memory lane?
Yeah, you know, we tell a lot of childhood stories and things like that. I don't know.
I'd go for it.
What people want to hear, I assume.
That's what I hear people want, more of that.
So, and this is all true. When I was a kid,
okay,
my Uncle Harry, avid monster movie and horror fan, and he had a book, a large hardcover slick photos of old horror and monster movies. And I remember as a kid thumbing through it.
Wait, was this like a coffee table book?
Yeah, yeah. It was okay. That kind of thing.
So it was there, you would look through it.
It was out, okay. Yeah. And this photo of this haunted face, and it was in black and white, grainy swirl of dust and all that. I remember his hair.
The hair.
Was like a foot high. And even as a little kid, you know, I was still just barely grasping toward literacy, but I could read it said Eraserhead. There was something about that photo that was so disturbing and haunting. I didn't know what the movie was, but there was something about the look on his face that I thought, this has to be the ultimate in scare.
So you know, how old were you?
You know, 8 or 9 years old. I don't know.
Yeah, that is unfair.
It was just,
terrifying.
It stuck with me so long that I was well into my adulthood before I ever worked up the nerve to actually watch the movie, because I assumed, you know, again, well into adulthood, it would just be too much for me.
Right. I mean, I think that picture is so iconic. I mean, I think before actually watching the film in question, right, tonight's film, Eraserhead. I carried that picture in my brain from seeing it.
Yeah.
I had no idea necessarily what it was connected to, but you're right. There's something about that photo that just kind of grabs a hold of your mind.
So, of course, tonight's director is David Lynch.
Yeah.
I was scared to do David Lynch.
You were.
I think we talked about it a little bit, like, you know, first season and all that. I even picked The Elephant Man as the perfect movie to watch over Halloween. So I don't dislike David Lynch at all. You know, don't mishear me. I don't know how to talk about David Lynch, and I felt completely ill-prepared to have a David Lynch
episode.
It was
really intimidating because of his work, I feel like, it's so diverse. There's so much of it. I mean, you could talk about his films, right? Feature films, short films. You can talk about his art. You can even talk about music. I mean, there's so much about David Lynch that you could talk about. So where do you even start?
Where do you start? Which is why it's fortuitous.
Yes.
That we called in the reinforcements this time around.
Exactly.
All that's to say, enough wind up. You may remember him from our Oscar special, but Jeff Jensen, our good friend, is back to join us. Jeff,
hello. Guys. How are you?
I'm so glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for
having me back.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Jeff. You're a writer of novellas, comics, graphic novels, screenplays, a journalist for many, many years, all things entertainment media, it feels like.
Yes, historically, that is somewhat accurate.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
when I was writing for Entertainment Weekly for, I believe 19 years, if I remember correctly, wrote a lot about movies, TV, and such. So, yes, pretty media saturated with David Lynch, of all things.
Well, you know what I was going to say?
A rather fixation and a beat that I covered for a long time, if you will.
And you know what? Because this is an important point, and it's no mistake, by the way, that we wanted Jeff to come back.
No, because I remember, Jeremy, you were saying, okay, if we're going to do a Lynch episode, I have one thing that we need.
Yeah.
And that is Jeff.
This is Jeff Jensen. So. Well, you, Jeff, have a specific connection. David Lynch, I understand, isn't necessarily given to entertainment journalism and sitting down and all that. But he's made a couple of exceptions, and my understanding is you're one of those exceptions.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to talk with him many times over the years. They often say in journalism that if you're not pissing someone off, you're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. So I guess I never pissed off David Lynch, so maybe I did something wrong as a journalist. I don't know. But if I recall correctly, like 1999, I was covering the Cannes Film Festival, and The Straight Story was playing there.
Oh, awesome.
And I managed to convince his publicist or someone to let me have 10 minutes with him. Nice. And he seemed to not dislike the conversation that we had about The Straight Story, which I loved, and his failed TV pilot at the time, A Mulholland Drive, soon to be a film and a great film at that. Beginning from that moment forward, I had an ongoing reporting kind of rapport with him, and over the years talked with him about The Straight Story, Twin Peaks, Mulholland Drive, his music, his artwork. After Cannes, the next time I interviewed him was at his home in the Hollywood Hills.
Really?
And if you've seen Lost Highway,
yes,
and you know Dick Laurent is dead. Mm-hmm. That's David's house.
No way.
That's David Lynch's house.
No kidding.
I didn't know that.
I don't think that's a big secret. David Lynch, The Art Life.
Right.
It's a fantastic documentary about his painting, but ultimately it functions as an origin story about how he got into art and how he transitioned out of painting and into filmmaking. And he actually tells the story of the making of Eraserhead. And that's kind of where that narrative stops. But he takes you into his home, and he takes you into his painting studio that's up on this little hill in back of his house. So to get there, you have to walk through like his garage, up a set of stairs, out the backyard, and up this path. And I've often said that that has been my favorite walk in all of my reporting days, because it's just to enter into his space where he makes art and to sit and talk with him in that space was a metaphor for me for like why I actually wanted to ever have that job in the first place, is just to speak with artists about what they do.
It's amazing.
And it was just really cool to make those visits with him.
Yeah.
Like, he's very protective of his process. He's very clear about what he will talk about and not talk about. And there have been many times where our conversations will be filled with awkward silence.
Yeah.
But I've always kind of accepted that, right, and had grace for that. He appreciates that. And at the same time, I feel like I've actually learned a lot from him. He said to me that, let me give you some advice on how to watch this film. Just feel your way through it. Like, don't try to think your way through it, but how does it feel? Just feel your way through the movie. That will most likely connect you with some kind of meaning. And the correct meaning, whether it's my meaning or whatever,
right,
that's what he wants, is for you to feel his way through. And so we've had some ongoing conversations over the years that have not necessarily been reflected in anything that I've written, but what it means to read a film and feel your way through it. And I've appreciated those conversations. I don't know if he has, but that's been part of our ongoing dialogue.
Right.
So the one thing I get the sense from David Lynch, at least from interviews that I've heard him give, is he does seem like a really generous person. He doesn't want to tell anybody what the film is supposed to mean or anything like that. But it does seem, for some reason, I'm like, I would love to talk with this man because of the way that he does talk and he does engage people.
Yeah.
It's kind.
I mean, and I did see that documentary that you were talking about, Jeff, the Art Life. I was struck by what an unassuming person he is.
Yeah.
I think I kind of assumed that you would get a very kind of mystery box personality or just this arm's length kind of a guy, but he seemed actually, I wouldn't go so far as to say inviting necessarily, but I don't know a better word really than unassuming. He has something he wants to give you, and he just wants you to have it, and that's about it. That's what I walk away with anyway.
There's always been some things that are off limits that he doesn't like to talk about. In particular, like going really deep into process. With this movie, for example, Eraserhead, one of the things that he has famously refused to ever discuss is the nature and the making of the baby, the creature thing.
Right.
He won't talk about
He won't talk about what that thing is.
Well, there's rumors like this was like an aborted calf and all kinds of things, or this is just something they built themselves. Yeah. What's that?
Well, the story that he has told many times is that when they were screening dailies, so that you're seeing lots of rough footage, including some behind the scenes stuff before you get into the actual shot, he would put a blindfold over the projectionist's eyes while they ran daily, so even the projectionist couldn't see how they really did the effect. That's one of those, you know, like legendary stories. I don't know if it's true or not, but is out there. But yeah, he's always been very protective of that behind the scenes secret.
That's
like
crazy.
So, like one of my favorite kind of like banters with him ever was when I talked with him about the Strait story.
Yeah.
So the Strait story is this based on the true story of Alvin Strait, who rode a tractor across at least one state and maybe two to be reunited with his ailing brother. So I wanted to know in the making of the film, how many tractors were used? And he refused to answer the question.
Oh, just no way.
On the grounds of like, what I want you to think is we use the same tractor. That's the only tractor that that Richard Farnsworth rode. And it was always him riding it. And so why would I want to tell you how many tractors we use? So I'm not going to answer your question. And some filmmakers are like that. Once I start going there, I start spoiling the magic of the film, and I end up subverting the effect that I want to have on you.
Yeah.
So I get that.
Let's talk a little about specifically about Eraserhead.
Yeah.
1977 film. I read 5 years in the making.
That's what I read too.
Something like that. Amazing. And apparently it was something where he got a decent little grip of money from AFI, but of course, that was based on like a 20-page screenplay,
but,
which you can, if you watch the movie, you can see how it could be a 20-page screenplay, but it wound up being a much longer film. So of course, keeping dollars in everyone's pockets was the big feat, and also something that I found to be very, very interesting. Lynch insisted on continuing to pay his cast and crew throughout, which is something that, you know, I think people in similar situations, you know, they would just need people, some of the crew and some of the cast, to just work gratis. But Lynch was committed to making sure that even if it was just a little bit, everyone continued to get paid.
That's wonderful.
Well, Jeff, how would you describe the premise? And it occurs to me that we do a lot of premises here. This is easily the hardest one that
this
we've ever had to do.
So difficult.
So Jeff,
this is the only reason why I'm here, so I can do this part of the of your podcast.
I just didn't know.
You just go home after you do this.
I didn't know how it would work.
If there was probably a movie that you guys have ever talked about, or a movie ever made where telling people what the premise of the film is actually irrelevant to the movie itself, it's probably this one, because we could set up what the movie's about, like plot-wise, but the movie is not about its plot. It's about the experience that this artist has created with sound and image, and what he wants you to feel in the context of this crazy story about this very peculiar man named Henry Spencer. He has this tall shock of hair, and he's played by the late Jack Nance. He lives in the most industrial part of town. You almost feel like it's a dystopian wasteland kind of thing of factories and machinery. And he lives in a certain apartment in this apartment building. And it's this almost as like this private little world of his own. And there is a radiator, and he likes to look into the radiator. And if you start looking through the things in the radiator, there's a tiny little theater in there where a whole fantasy world resides. And you come to find out that Henry had or has a girlfriend or not, and they maybe, I guess, had a child. And
The most liberal use of the word child I've ever heard.
All of this comes out during a very weird, like, dinner at her parents' house. This child that they've had together is, it looks like some kind of like skinned animal wrapped in gauze.
Right.
And so now they are living in Henry's apartment and caring for this creature child who constantly cries. I don't want to say the word surreal, and maybe we could talk about why in a second, but like a very weird, abstracted portrait of marriage, parenthood, art, all sorts of other cosmic and strange things, and ultimately leads to a one damn freaky, weird, scary sequence after another. A very peculiar, like, musical number includes at one point Henry being decapitated and his head being used to make erasers, and culminating with the greatest, most gruesome, and weirdest infanticide in the history of cinema. So, spoiler alert, it's a very weird movie.
Yeah, it's so super disturbing.
It is.
I don't really know how else to put it.
Frame after frame, really.
And, okay, so weird, disturbing, funny.
It's really funny.
Yeah, it is kind funny, of a really funny movie.
And that's something that I think that I forget until I'm actually in the middle of watching it. This is one of those movies that's almost kind of hard to forget your first time watching it, because, you know, it's almost like, where were you when the Berlin Wall came down? Where were you when Eraserhead came at your face, you know, and invaded your brain? How did you handle it? I mentioned a little bit up front, I was scared to watch the movie. And then, of course, several years ago, I said, no, you know, my wife and I, we sat down, we watched it.
Date night?
Yeah. And here was my hubris. I thought, oh, wasn't that funny how scared I was of just this image? And now that I'm a mature adult, and it kept me up half the night because it just, the images wouldn't leave. As an adult, you know, this is just, I'm in my early 40s now. This is not more than a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And it just clung to those folds in my brain. I couldn't get these thoughts out. There's violence, I guess. And yeah, there's blood and, you know, those sorts of things. But that's not really necessarily the blood and the violence. It's just lingering, unsettled, non sequitur. I don't know what that is, but how does that happen? How does that get underneath who you are? I don't know. I just, it was a tough movie to get through. I'm not going to lie to you. So, but yeah, vividly remember.
When I first saw Eraserhead, I was probably a junior in college. So it was whenever Mulholland Drive came out. That's when I recognized or understood that I was watching a David Lynch film for the first time, was that film. So I'd seen The Elephant Man. I saw The Straight Story. But I didn't make any connections. I saw Eraserhead. There's something happens for me, at least, as a film student, where I was kind of detached from the experience when I was watching it, kind of for craft and, oh wow, this is really beautiful looking, or how are they doing this? That I didn't really feel my way through the film, I don't think. And so it wasn't until preparing for this that I think that happened. And because I had trouble sleeping, I woke up in the middle of the night. Couldn't go back to sleep, so I thought, okay, I'll watch Eraserhead, you know, and that'll I'll eventually get tired.
Yeah.
And then watching it, and it was that I can't stop looking, and I'm being pulled through that, where these feelings and the sense is kind of growing,
right?
Feeling completely uneasy about everything around me, because of this film that I'm watching. This is affecting me the way that I think Lynch wanted it to affect me.
And I think that I'm actually glad that I didn't see it until later in life, because I worry that if I had seen it too early, I would have just never returned to it, because it would have been too much. It begs you to ask these questions. Well, hang on, what's a dream and what's real?
Yeah.
And by the end of the movie, there's so much more important questions than that. Where does the real start and the real end? Well, come on.
Right.
I mean, what, you may as well ask, why is blue? You know, you're just carried along this whole experience. Something's a dream within a dream. There are these images on film, and they're taking hold of you. That's way more important than trying to get to the bottom of what's a dream and what isn't a dream. Absolutely. In my opinion, anyway. What about you, Jeff? Do you recall your first viewing?
I do recall my first viewing. It was the summer of 1990, and it was the peak moment of David Lynch's like pop culture phenom days. His career had rebounded from the disaster of Dune with Blue Velvet, for which he got an Oscar nomination. everyone was gearing up for the second season of Twin Peaks, also gearing up for the premiere of Wild at Heart, which had just won the Cannes Film Festival, the grand prize there. A lot of hype around David Lynch. And so it was time to fill in the gaps of my David Lynch knowledge. And by that time in the summer of 90, I'd long since seen The Elephant Man and Dune, both of which I liked. Even Dune.
Even Dune, Jeff.
You love Dune.
I love Dune. That's now, awesome. I understand. I see the movie that you all see. And I understand it's weird, wonky, broken, bad. But the one movie I hadn't seen was Eraserhead. I think I was intimidated by Eraserhead for a number of reasons, mostly because on a gut level, I think what I knew was that this was going to be a very different kind of David Lynch movie. I came into David Lynch fandom through these very weird, perverse noir films that he did, personal noir, like Blue Velvet and then Twin Peaks. Movies and TV shows that are very original and very Lynchian, but still have some sort of like genre context for them, so that there are some implied rules, even if he's completely subverting them or twisting them in some crazy way. But I kind of knew that Eraserhead wasn't going to be that. And true to form, watching this slowly paced, atmospheric, burn, weird plot, like cryptic narrative, I was tired, exasperated, bored by it. There were some images that were really arresting in that moment. I think it really picks up as it goes along, and a lot of David Lynch things finish pretty fast, furious, and scary. And this was, I think, kind of no exception a little bit. It's pretty gripping. So it casts a spell that's kind of hard to appreciate, but then it really kind of pays off, I think. But still, I just didn't really like it, to be honest with you, when I first saw it. It is a movie about fatherhood, anxieties about intimacy and marriage and all of that. And strangely enough, as weird as this movie is, there are some moments in it that just feel so universal and relatable, like, you know, sharing a bed with someone and kind of move over and all of that, and just the experience of having a crying child in your bedroom. Like, I was like, oh, I've been there now.
Yeah.
But not when I was 20. This movie, for many years, was sort of marketed as, or positioned as, or talked about as some kind of midnight movie, cult movie kind of thing.
Right.
And oftentimes pegged or classified to a genre, horror mostly.
Yeah.
Sci-fi I've read in other places, but that kind of makes no sense.
Right. The image reminds me of something like you would see like connected to Ed Wood.
Right. Yeah. And so what I was expecting, I think, was something a little bit more trashy fun, maybe.
Yeah.
A little bit more like So Bad It's Good.
Yeah. Something kind of grindhouse-ier.
Yeah. Something a little bit more sensationalistic.
Yeah.
Now, this film is sensational in the literal sense of the word. Whatever it is I thought like midnight movie meant, this wasn't it.
Right.
One of the things I would just say about this movie in general, which I appreciate now, is just how this thing really is a very personal piece of art that defies any genre label. And I think that's kind of what is the enduring revolutionary nature of the whole thing, is that this painter turned filmmaker, applying kind of more of that fine art painterly sensibility to making a movie that is extremely personal to the point of being inscrutable, and saying this can be a movie too.
Yeah.
Pretty radical thing to do in the year of Star Wars when this movie came out.
That's one of the things I really appreciated about the film. And I think Lynch films in general is that he has such a command of all the different elements at his disposal in making a movie. Mm-hmm. But for me, the thing that stuck out so clearly in watching Eraserhead this time around was not what I saw, but what I heard. Mm-hmm. Like, that was what was crazy for me in kind of experiencing it in the way that I did, is the photography is beautiful.
Sure.
And I love that. But I could not get over what I was hearing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what was haunting me constantly. The moment that grabbed me in that way was when, the little pups are feeding on the mother.
Right.
That sound, haunted me in the film, and I'm like, okay, something is happening, and then I couldn't unhear the rest of the film. You know, it was just it was a really fascinating experience.
I mean, even the moments where it's sort of this sort of ethereal head trip, deep space, you know, what is that, an asteroid or a planet that's kind of superimposing his face on top of, which is another, you know, Lynch staple, you know, the face that's looking into camera, but yet also superimposed with other sorts of imagery and that kind of thing. And yet what you're hearing is the hum of, is it wind? Is it machinery? Right. Is it all that? Is it the mechanics of the universe going on?
Or
it just, it's not really definable, but yet it's making you feel a certain way. It gives you that feeling, and it gives you that Lynch feeling. I want to be able to talk about it better, but it's impossible.
Yeah, right.
So if you've watched a lot of Lynch over the years, it is pretty amazing going back to this film. And I haven't seen Eraserhead in many, many years. I actually tried to watch it to inform a lot of my writing about Twin Peaks, The Return. And I didn't make it through all of it. But now having just watched it all again for this conversation, just really struck by how many Lynchian motifs or techniques introduced here, pioneered here, that he would repeat or build upon in upcoming films, of his films after this. But yeah, his attention to sound is legendary and a huge part of his storytelling. He loves that combination of sound, which he would probably also include music in there with image, and how those things work together to work on you. I watched Twin Peaks, The Return with closed captioning on.
Right.
And whenever that sound effect comes on, Showtime's closed captioning describes it as atmospheric whooshing. That is just very evocative and very sinister, and like that seems to speak to some cosmic horror or the cosmic machinations of the world. That and his fixation with electricity. So this movie, Eraserhead, just plants that flag very, very firmly. Yeah. His fascination and fixation and even fear of what electricity is and what it represents. I've heard him once talk about how he just finds it really weird and unsettling and marvelous to think about this electricity, this phantom energy, that we bring it into our homes and it's around us. And what does that do to us? And but his sort of fetishization of like electricity, what that means as a cosmic force, perhaps. You know?
That's a great thread.
Yeah.
I love that. I was struck by, he seems to really think a lot about the 50s. He loves clubs and diners and things like that, of that era, sometimes a warped version of that. But I was thinking about, even as I was watching Eraserhead and I was watching the woman with the facial growths singing, the woman in the radiator.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's doing that performance and all that. And I thought, you know, if someone were to say, sum up David Lynch, I would say it's a person on a stage.
Yep.
That in any other context, you have reason to sort of feel bad for, you know, for some reason, but yet you're drawn in by some sort of funny, quirky, but yet also heartbreaking performance that they're giving, whether that's literally happening or metaphorically happening. And I think a version of that is happening in almost every single one of his films.
Well, he has that. I mean, I think you're right. And that's a question that I'm so curious about is what is it about his fixation on performance? You know, what is he getting at there? I think that there does seem to be a stage, a singer, or some sort of band in all the films that at least I can think of, right? The Lynch films.
I don't know. Is that autobiographical, do you think, Jeff? I don't know. What is that?
You know what? That's a really great observation. And I've never talked with him about that. But yeah, that, like, and you see that here, don't we? Like, you know, there is this reoccurring fixation with performance. It was a big part of Twin Peaks The Return. Every episode of Twin Peaks The Return end with someone on stage performing a musical number. Did you guys watch Twin Peaks The Return?
I've only watched like the first four episodes.
I haven't made it all the way there yet.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely amazing. In some ways, Twin Peaks The Return is a really great bookend to Eraserhead because you really kind of feel that Lynch. Hopefully he'll direct many, many more things here in the last act of his life. I mean, he's 70 plus now, I believe. It really felt in these 18 hours a kind of summing up aesthetically and even thematically of a lot of his work.
You're a fine man, Bushnell Mullins. I will not soon forget your kindness and decency.
What about the FBI?
I am the FBI.
He returns to the theme of fatherhood and marriage again and divorce in this work. But there are moments that feel like overt homages to Eraserhead at the beginning of part three of Twin Peaks The Return, which seems to take place in that sort of ethereal metaphysical space of that Eraserhead opens up in. You see in this in Eraserhead this other kind of fixation that pops into some of his work, but not always. But there's a mythic world that is parallel to and intersects with our world of strange characters and peculiar, you know, psychopomps and angels and demons and such that might be projections of a character's psychology or might actually be some kind of supernatural being from some Jungian archetype fantasy, you know, like a mystical space. Lynch doesn't care how we interpret that. All those things could be true. Those kinds of characters pop up in a lot of other things like Lost Highway or Mulholland Drive. I feel like you get those characters here in the form of the lady in the radiator or the guy, the man in the world, like pulling all the levers.
Right. Another deformed, scarred character. He loves handicaps and deformities.
Right. So body horror, like, you know, quote unquote freakishness.
Yeah.
Passive aggressive, like voyeur characters, like happen to pop up often.
Yeah.
The industrial juxtaposed with the organic, you know, machinery and the organic kind of like coexisting, decay, mud, excrement. You know that great moment in Blue Velvet when he finds the ear and we push in on the ear and we go inside the ear? He likes doing that, or these things, these objects or spaces with dark innards, and he kind of pushes in there, and that's where you get the atmospheric whooshing when you kind of go in there as if there a whole universe is contained in there. There's another thing that he does that I've always loved. Like, I love this phrase, neighborhood stories or neighborhood noir, where he likes to take this idea of a very small locale, but within this small locale, you can find the whole world, if not the entire universe, and maybe a whole multiverse of places, you know, places within places, spaces within spaces. That's something that he talks about in David Lynch, The Art Life, that idea of like when he was a boy growing up, his world, he said, was very small. It was confined to like a block or a few blocks, but he played outside constantly. And he was such an imaginative kid that he kind of felt like that his world was small, but it was huge too. Yeah.
The story that still stays with me from that documentary is he talks about the woman that he encountered as a little boy.
Out of the darkness comes this strangest dream. And she had beautiful, pale white skin. And she was completely naked. And I think her mouth was bloodied. And she came closer and closer, and my brother started to cry. Something was bad wrong with her. And I don't know what happened, but I think she sat down on a curb crying. But it was very mysterious. I wanted to do something for her, but I was little. I didn't know what to do. And I don't remember any more than that.
I don't know. You can see how something like that would inform a David Lynch. The scene he describes is such a Lynchian scene. I really love that. The interruption of this very specific, normalized situation with a whole other situation that's maybe twice as human as anything that he's ever experienced. And that's where the art is. Well, I've said this in the past. In fact, I think I mentioned it on our Halloween episode, Daniel, that it would be an exaggeration to call myself a David Lynch guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's partly why I was so excited to have this discussion tonight, because I don't really know what to make of David Lynch. Even still, I don't know what to make of David Lynch. You know, I do gravitate more to like maybe The Elephant Man. Haven't seen The Straight Story, but it sounds like something I might gravitate more toward. But I'll also admit that I can't stop watching David Lynch, except for Dune. I had no problem putting that one down.
You could stop watching
Dune. Dune was all right to end at about the halfway mark. But no, otherwise, it was this sure-handed, compelling nature to what he's doing, certainly as a freshman film, Eraserhead, that slow pace, that deliberateness. I mean, my goodness, made over the course of 5 years, to have that sort of consistency of vision over 5 years for something that's paced that deliberately. I think I heard another interview with him where he was talking about the humor of Eraserhead, the elevator doors, the close, and it lingers on the closed elevator doors. And you can see just in the sliver of light that's left in between the closed doors, the elevator begin to rise past our view. Even after it's completely gone from our view, we linger and we continue to linger. And yeah, it's unsettling, but also there's something that's kind of funny about it. And there are these conflicting feelings at the same time. I have no doubt in my mind that he wants me to feel what I'm feeling in that moment, which is gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so the scene you described, and I haven't seen the documentary, but that moment does feel very Lynchian in the sense that he's not really concerned with backstory necessarily, right? What's more interesting to him is how he is affected by what he saw. He has such a faith that things can be connected by the people who are watching them, that he doesn't necessarily have to make the connection, but that whatever is happening between the images and the sounds, the people viewing them, that in and of itself is profound. And there's such faith in that, that I begin to learn something about myself, which is really wild watching a, you know, like something like Eraserhead. I was surprised and unsettled by finding a sense of connection, right? With Henry Spencer.
Right.
Like all of a sudden, like that happens. Yeah. And when I come to a moment and I'm thinking like, oh, I understand. And if, I don't even want to finish that, right? Yeah. If I have that thought, it's like, wait a second, what does that mean about, what does that say about me and what's going on and this child thing and how Henry feels about this child? All of a sudden, I'm implicated.
Yeah, you can't tell me that David Lynch doesn't want you to feel that.
Exactly.
We spend so much time in Henry's gaze, in his face, just looking into Henry himself as a person. You can't not connect to him, even though he's this strange, haunted sort of figure.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think of Jimmy Corrigan, Chris Ware's character.
Right.
Henry is a Jimmy Corrigan, this completely ineffectual person who, for some reason, you have nothing but just complete sympathy for and complete understanding of, and yet you know there's not really anything you can do to help him.
Absolutely. That really struck me watching it again. I mean, he's so freaking peculiar and specific that you think that you can't connect to him.
Right.
I found him like really moving, this very strange, alienated, confused in his own mind and body person who doesn't really know what he wants, and but also maybe knows what he doesn't want or doesn't like, or and trying to navigate his life. I don't know, maybe I can relate to him more than I want to admit, you know, but he's an incredibly compelling figure more and more as I get older.
Yeah, I was also really intrigued by Mary, the girlfriend. You laugh out loud at the suitcase moment. You know what I mean? The tug, tug, tug,
which
tug.
I wasn't even sure what she was doing.
No.
Like, I couldn't remember that moment. And I'm thinking, Wait, is this some sort of like sexual metaphor? Like, okay, and then, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you know, for those who don't know what I'm talking about, there's a moment when, of course, Henry and Mary are spending their first nights together with the new quote-unquote baby. And, of course, the crying of this baby is driving everyone a little bit crazy. Eventually, Mary, the girlfriend, makes a decision that she needs to leave. And she needs to go back with her parents for maybe a night or two.
She just needs to get some sleep.
She has to just get some sleep.
She's been driven crazy from not having any sleep.
That's right.
And maybe having a mutant for a child.
It's, who knows?
That'll do it.
One of those two things.
She reaches under the bed and she starts tugging the bed that Henry is currently laying on. And she's tugging. The whole bed is just scraping back and forth against the floor. And this goes on for too long.
It's so long.
And then it continues to go on for too long.
So long.
You better take real good care of things while I'm gone.
You laugh and then you stop laughing and then you start laughing again because it's just too long.
It's the rakes. It's the Simpsons rakes thing. Have you ever seen that gag?
The which one?
Okay. So it's the rule of the rakes. It's a Simpsons gag where I forget what character is, but Google the Simpsons rakes and you will find it, where there is a character. He is in a yard filled with all of these rakes and he steps on one and it hits him in the face. He steps on another one. It hits him in the face. He steps on another one. It hits him in the face. The first couple times, it's kind of funny. Then like fifth time, still kind of funny. Sixth time, it's like, okay, this is really going on. Yeah. Seventh time, okay, come on. What's going on? But by the 15th time, it's like, okay. Like, how long are they going to keep it going?
It's so absurd. Not funny back into funny again.
Right. So, like, Lynch loves that kind of comedy, right? Yeah. That sort of, like, long take, slow comedy.
Right.
It will often in times involve doddering old people.
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right.
He loves just sort of, like, watching them, like, flail and shuffle and try to do stuff in the frame. The other moment in Eraserhead that reminds me of the business of pulling the suitcase from out underneath the bed is when the kid brings Henry's head to the eraser factory.
Right.
And the guy that is working the counter there, he comes out and he just starts pressing the button over and over again to buzz his boss and buzz, buzz. But like, that's kind of like classic Lynch comedy too.
Yeah, that reminds me of that moment in Mulholland Drive with the parents that are smiling in the back of the car. This odd, weird sense of something that's happening too long and it's, oh, this is kind of cute. Okay.
And speaking of smiling, Mr. X, the dad.
Oh.
Just with the unending smile
the mom or is it who's behind him at the
X is behind
the daughter.
That was a great shot.
That is great.
Really creepy.
Just unending. But even Mary, the actress Charlotte Stewart, mentioned later in an interview she was completely unsure of what David Lynch was asking of her. Because apparently he's behind the camera, and this is according to her in a later interview.
When we were shooting that, David said, just keep pulling till I tell you to pull it out. And I thought he had gone way too far. And that is more David's style. He lets things go beyond the point of comfort, and he gets something else.
Are there precedents for things like that? I mean, was that a popular style of humor? I don't know. And that's one thing that I was wondering as I was watching Eraserhead. Clearly, this is an innovative film. Mm-hmm. How innovative was it, though? Were there influences that David Lynch was looking at and saying, yeah, I want some of that, or was this just completely his own brainchild?
Well, so, and here's I want to kind of go back to something you said earlier, Jeff, which is the term you don't like to associate with Lynch, or maybe it was this film in particular, is surrealism.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard people talk about Lynch that's almost an immediate connection that people make. What Lynch is doing is offering like something like the surreal or a surreal film. So that might be a temptation of categorizing what Lynch is attempting to do, but you don't like that.
Because he said as much. I think in interviews, he's spoken to the issue of surrealism, and I wish I had a greater command of what he said. I think he has tried to like distinguish himself from surrealists. Not that he doesn't enjoy surrealism or he doesn't get the connection that people are trying to make, but I don't think that he considers himself a surrealist as he understands it. And maybe even as I understand it either, I tend to think in terms of abstractions, which is a term that I know that he has used.
Yeah, that's
where
good.
He thinks about just trying to put on screen a feeling with sound and image and the subject matter of the scene, or how he can rearrange a scene or a narrative to create abstractions that produce certain kinds of feelings that are more than just what the scene's about or about something else entirely. I don't feel like I'm the biggest expert on surrealism, but the more Lynch that I watch, the more I don't really know if surrealism is the right word. Personal seems kind of like accurate. Like language is sort of like problematic when we're trying to like apply it and sum up a Lynch. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Even going back to my art history days, I mean, is there a more famous surrealist than Dali? Probably not. But if you look at the intent of the surrealist movement, you see things like intentionally representing a dream state, representing the sometimes even biological abstraction of a thought form, the ability to take something that's a terrific distance away and still represent it in vivid detail. And no, not all of those things, I would say, apply to David Lynch, but I would argue that some of them actually do.
Sure.
I don't know that there's a more accurate depiction of what I would consider a nightmare than Eraserhead, if I'm being honest. In fact, throughout the whole movie, I've never experienced a director who's able to evoke what it feels like to be asleep and having a very unsettling dream than what I'm watching right now. And Giger mentioned that what Lynch was able to achieve with Eraserhead was closer to his own personal vision than his own personal work.
Whoa.
Which was to evoke these certain types of feelings and this kind of visceral quality. Lynch was able to somehow climb that mountain with Eraserhead. I don't know. It's just so interesting when you go across the board, when you hear stories like Stanley Kubrick having his cast before filming The Shining watch Eraserhead and say, this is what I want to capture.
I mean, sound design, right? I mean, there's so much of I would say, connection between Eraserhead and the use of sound and probably The Shining and what Kubrick is doing there for sure.
Without a doubt. I mean, and this may be apocryphal also, but I did read a snippet about George Lucas considering David Lynch for, one of the films in the Star Wars trilogy.
Really?
This is true.
Is that really true?
Oh, yeah. So he was up for Return of the Jedi.
Really?
Yeah. There was two movies in the mid-80s, I want to say, that Lynch was up for as he was thinking about what he wanted to make next after The Elephant Man. One of them was Return of the Jedi.
Wow.
And I think he was also offered Red Dragon, the Thomas Harris Hannibal Lecter novel.
No kidding.
That Michael Mann ended up making into Manhunter. And if you think about the impact that obviously the Star Wars films had on pop culture, and then the impact that the Thomas Harris novels had on pop culture, seeding the pop's fascination with serial killers. Ultimately, Silence of the Lambs will come along and kind of revolutionize that. Jonathan Demme, a director that probably owes maybe a little bit to Lynch, but not like a ton, but I can see that. Anyway, this is all to say, can you imagine if Lynch directed those two films?
Right.
And like what pop culture would look like today?
Right. Like
if David Lynch had directed Return of the Jedi.
Oh my gosh.
And then like wow. A Red Dragon movie and like, would he have completely derailed like pop culture as we know it, or completely enhanced it, like, or just certainly changed the face of it? I don't know.
You know, one of those movies I want to see, and I don't want to see the other one. I would love to see his Red Dragon, but Return of the Jedi by way of Dune, I think I'll pass on that one. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know, but. So there was one question I wanted to ask that I'm curious about even more than some of our usual stuff. Of all the movies that we've talked about, Daniel, and by the way, we're coming off of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Which is coming off of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Mm-hmm. So
those are like cousins to Eraserhead.
Yeah, exactly. And then and here we are. We're winding down from Valentine's Day here, but
winding down. Eraserhead's a chaser to Valentine's
Day. Yeah, this is your Valentine's Day chaser. But nevertheless, I don't think that there would be anything that we've had yet in any of our episodes that could be more considered a quote-unquote art film as Eraserhead. But I really was thinking about this in recent days. What is an art film? Is that just like comfort food for us to be able to put something in the category of art film? What is an art film? Does this qualify? Why do we need that category? I was just curious what you guys thought about that. What do you think? What's an art film, first of all?
I mean, I think that's an interesting question. There's a lot to be interpreted. I mean, it does not give a lot to the viewer in terms of how it is supposed to be thought about or understood. Even experienced. I mean, I'd probably say it requires a certain willingness on the part of a viewer to engage it and to not simply be like a passive observer or to let the film do something for you, but that you're going to bring yourself to it. Something's going to happen, at least in that exchange. I mean, that's kind of my immediate answer to the question. Yeah.
So you would say if you go to something and someone says, oh, by the way, Daniel, you should see this. It's an art film. Does that inspire you to want to see it more? Or does that, I guess part of the reason I ask is certainly there's a lot of people that would use that term dismissively. Like, well, you know what? Yeah. It's it's an art film. And if you're into that kind of artsy fartsy shit, then yeah, go to it. But there's the other side of it too, where, you know, some certain people like that, they like to experience art, capital A. I guess I'm trying to figure out what the utility of that is.
Like the actual, the description.
Yeah, using that as a term. I mean, is all film art, you know? I mean, you know, is Batman versus Superman Ultimate Edition, is that an art film?
Well, see, I think that...
Well, the Ultimate Edition is. No, yeah. I'm just kidding.
Because it's rated R.
So. Well, I do think that could be an unhelpful like moniker because I think it assumes that art in and of itself is not easily understood, right? That there's something about art. If you're going to look at art, there's something there. It may not be immediately recognized. So it's going to require, for lack of a better word, work.
Yeah.
And probably extended or repeated viewing of a piece, right? And I do think it's a dismissive term that people, when people use that term, there's going to be something about it where you're like, okay, there's a lot about that I didn't understand, or there's things I'm missing. I'm going to have to go watch that again. Do I even want to? And then all of a sudden it feels like it's more work than maybe it's worth.
Yeah. Would you say it's the antithesis of a commerce film? I mean, not that people say commerce film, but is that the opposite number?
I think when people use the term, I think that they're suggesting that.
Yeah.
I think they are using it in contrast to something that would probably be more mainstream or like a blockbuster or something that people would probably choose to go see, right? I mean,
yeah
I don't know. This is an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. It's and what it leads me to is that the phrase ultimately is maybe not one we should use.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, but I understand what you're saying. I've used that term before too. I think I probably even used that term in relationship to something I respect and admire, like Eraserhead, but also to things that like I just don't get, Solaris, like half of the films in the Tartakovsky catalog, you know, like, so, but I think that when you're confronted with the word art film, it can be used in a dismissive way. It's not a fair term because I do think there's artfulness in almost every film, regardless of what it's chasing or what it wants to be. Eraserhead's an art film, but you know, Silence of the Lambs is art too, you know. But when we use art film, like I guess in the context of something like Eraserhead, it should cause you to pause and then just reflect on, okay, then we'll... what does art mean to you then? Yeah. What is the purpose of art? But what it kind of like gets me thinking, and among many things, is that how often I think that people don't even think of movies as art.
In general.
Like they make this distinction between art and entertainment.
Right.
A question then is that I think that when we're calling Eraserhead an art film, what we're trying to say is that Lynch isn't trying to entertain you. I think that's what someone could be doing, this hypothetical person who is using the phrase art film. But you know what? I think that David is trying to entertain.
That's what I think he would say that.
I think he would too. I think he wants you to be entertained by it. I don't know if he would say this, but I would say that maybe the notion of what entertains us can be broadened. Mm-hmm. The other thing I keep on going back to this idea of personal. I do think when I think about art film in relationship to Eraserhead, I am confronted, though, by a guy who is just approaching cinema and what he wants to do with it and how he wants to use it as a means of expression that I do think is probably very different than most people who get behind a camera and make a movie, you know? He's not trying to, like, create, not that all directors do this, but create a product that can be marketed and advance some corporation's mass merchandising strategies and or something like that. He's not trying to make Jurassic Park for sure, you know? Not that there's anything wrong with Jurassic Park. He's pursuing something different and incredibly valuable. Like, you know, like I don't want more Eraserheads in the world, but I wish that there were, that we had an industry that supported directors to make more personal statements, that where directors were approaching the screen the way a painter approaches a canvas and expresses themselves this way. I remember having something of a similar conversation with you guys last year when we talked about the film Moonlight. One of the reasons why I was excited to see the Academy bestow that film with the Oscar, which it did after mistakenly giving it to La La Land. That's funny. I don't know to what degree that film is personal for Barry Jenkins, the filmmaker, but that did strike me as a personal film.
Well, I think that's partly why it's so interesting to think of David Lynch in the context of directing Return of the Jedi, which, by the way, is one of my favorite films of all time. But I can't bring myself to call that an art film beyond like the most just general definition of, yes, it is art. Of course, it's art. And I'll defend it as art. But to describe it as an art film gives you an impression that's completely other than what it actually is. And I think you're onto something, Daniel, when you say it requires something of you, you know, when you consider something an art film. You're going to have to work at this is sort of the implication. But I think there's a good point when you're saying how helpful is that term actually, because is that a way of just downgrading non-art films? And, you know, I don't know, but this is where all the places my brain was kind of spinning the last week or so.
You know what's interesting, though? Like when you said you have to work at it, I was thinking about that notion relationship to the films of David Lynch and this one in particular, films that you have to work at. I want to be clear. I like work in a movie. You know, I like thinking about it, overthinking about it, talking about it. But I also think, though, that the good films, the great films, should be able to work for you without you working it, if that makes sense, right? And in fact, I like them all, even Dune. but the ones that I like best, like they just kind of wash over me and transport me, and they make me feel things, and they're making me think things too, but I don't have to make them work to work. So I love Mulholland Drive. And that is a movie of varied tones, and it starts one place and it takes you someplace unexpected, and it takes all sorts of detours and tangents along the way. And the narrative has some kind of like psychotic break somewhere mm-hmm. 2/3 of the way, and it becomes something else. And is it a dream? Is it not? Where does the dream end and begin? Blah, blah, blah. But that movie works for me because I just watch it. I just get lost in it.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel things, and it takes me someplace, and then it's over, and I don't want it to end, mm-hmm. but then it's over. And that works. Blue Velvet has always worked for me in that way. The right. straight story has always mm-hmm. worked for me that way. The Elephant Man works for me in that way. Dune, you have to make that work for you to appreciate.
Sure.
You know, I think that Wild at Heart is so is so sensationalistic and so ironic and postmodern. It works, but it doesn't work. Like you have to rationalize that film mm-hmm. in some way. Lost Highway is work.
Oh yeah,
Lost Highway.
And I love Lost Highway. Mm-hmm. But Lost Highway is work.
Yeah,
Twin Peaks: Fire Walk With Me is a broken film. You have to make that work for you. Eraserhead is somewhere in the middle for me. It might actually be the hinge between work and not work mm-hmm. for me. Like, you know, I can just let Eraserhead be the freaky thing and wash over it, but I feel I'm still doing things like researching David Lynch's biography and trying to read him into mm-hmm. it to make sense of it or like interpret it to make it work. And I don't necessarily want to do that if all of that makes sense to mm-hmm. you.
No, I think that's really interesting, which brings us directly into the conversation that we have a lot, mm-hmm. which is almost a strange question to ask when it comes to David Lynch. But, you know, we talk about that freshman film, that first film, clearly in this case, a very special, specific film. Where does Eraserhead fit? I don't know. In this conversation, it almost feels gauche to talk about it in terms of like a ranking or something like that. So whatever the case, interpret how you want. But where do you put Eraserhead in the overall body of work of David Lynch?
So kind of bypassing the rank, I do think that your language, Jeff, is helpful as kind of like that hinge point between some of those films that I love. I mean, the ones you named. And the films that I haven't even figured out how to make work for me, like something like Inland Empire, I don't even know where to start in terms of working it, you know. And I guess the question I need to ask is, am I willing to do that? And I guess I'm not, because I, you know, I've watched it once and I'm thinking, okay, there are other Lynch films I'd just rather rewatch. And so, yeah, but Eraserhead, now seeing it, you know, I'm 36 and a father of two, and am extremely haunted by it. What I saw of myself in it, you know. And I think that was, that to me is what made it really profound. It changes, I think, its importance for me and as a film I actually want to go back to and consider in different ways. And it's a film that I think works in really remarkable ways. I'd say in surprising ways, in ways that I wasn't ready for in this kind of season of rewatching it.
Yeah.
What about you?
You know, And I love hearing you talk about it, because I think you're right. I think there are these resonant moments in Eraserhead. They shine a flashlight on things that we don't like talking about. Mm-hmm. All three of us are fathers, and we've all, if we're being honest, we've had that thought. We've had that, I could just walk out the door right now and let this screaming kid just leave this kid alone in the house to just scream. Horrible. And we don't do that, but we've all had that thought. David Lynch mainlines that feeling into our brains and puts it up on the big screen in Eraserhead. And I think it's just, you know, even beyond all the interesting lighting and all the non sequiturs and all this creepy feeling, those are the kind of moments, I think, mm-hmm. that make Eraserhead this wild sort of like, oh, wow, you're really socking me in the gut with this. You know, it's that shared experience, that so abstracted but still shared. I can't walk away from Eraserhead and go, wow, I love that.
Right.
You know, I just, it's not letting me do that. But at the same time, I can call it importance mm-hmm. and I can call it gravity. And Jeff, that thing that you described with the David Lynch isn't trying to get this plot across to you. He's trying to get across to you. He's trying to make you feel a certain way. And his whole reason in life is to get you to feel that thing that he wants you to feel. And that transcends plot in this case. That's awesome. That's mm-hmm. incredible. That's, you know, like you said, Elephant Man did that. I can't call Eraserhead my favorite David Lynch film. I just, you know, there's others that I enjoy more. But yeah, I would put that in the upper part of what I regard. I think part of it is because I really like Mulholland Drive a lot. It's hard for me, even with Mulholland Drive, to make myself stop analyzing and trying to understand plot kinds of things. For some reason, I have no problem at all when it comes to Eraserhead. Mm-hmm. I sink right into not worrying about plot at all. And it is what it is. And I think it's successfully that. So yeah, I'm not going to give you a rank or something like that. But I will say that, yeah, for me, it's one of the more effective David Lynch films. Mm-hmm. Leave it there, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, to clarify for me, like, it's interesting. I really like how you put all of it, particularly your use of the word importance. This is a really important movie. I mean, I think it's a really important movie when we talk about cinema in the past 50 some odd years, how it was made, how it was exhibited and released, and then kind of the influence it had on other filmmakers and its audience, and how the audience carried it forward and helped carry Lynch into the mainstream. I mean, Lynch is like one of those movie makers that has had a just so profound influence on so many other filmmakers. You know, the wider audience, you know, doesn't dig him as much as we do or whatever, but he's pretty important in terms of like the artistic life of cinema. You know, he's a guy that I think that other people in Hollywood pay attention to. You know, you can't really ignore. And this is the film that launched him and started it all. And I think that a lot of people come back to. I mean, if you want pure heroin hit Lynch, this is one of those things that you would inject, you know? You have to put Eraserhead in the top third of his body of work in terms of great movies. Yeah. But if I had to make a list, though, of the Lynch films that I would rewatch tomorrow.
Sure. Desert Island Movies.
Right. I wouldn't be too surprised if I'm not, if Eraserhead, that Eraserhead DVD is toward the very bottom of the stack. You know, which may say something about my own shallowness, because you're right. The feelings that it captures, I'm struck by this man who keeps this space, his apartment, his entire world is this apartment. And it's, and you get the sense that it is his sanctuary, his shelter, his world. And then he is basically forced to marry the mother of this child. And now he has to share this space. He has to bring this person mm-hmm. into this space. Yeah. And it's such a disruption for him and her, as is this child. That idea and the emotions that come with it, the feelings that come with it that he puts on screen are incredibly relatable and uncomfortable, you know? So it's a movie about what happens when about sharing our lives with other people and what a disruption that is for better and worse. I mean, it is a film about marriage, right? But it's also a film about adultery. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, right. It's interesting that the parts of the film that I start liking more are activated by, but maybe it's because I see more of a narrative in there than any other part. It's like that passage of things where he is tempted by the woman across the hall.
Yeah.
And then he transgresses with her.
Where's your wife?
She must have gone back to her parents again. I'm not sure.
Can I spend the night here?
And that's when all of a sudden he descends in some kind of hell in the radiator and gets his head popped off. And then he gets his head turned into, like, he's clearly being punished for something. Wonder what that's about. But adultery, another interesting theme that keeps on popping up.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I like this time around because, you know, a little over a year ago, Daniel, you and I asked the question, bringing it back around full circle to THX, what's the purpose of film? And I feel like this time around, we've got maybe just a little bit more of a glimpse of what is the purpose. I don't know that we'll ever fully answer that question, but I like thinking about that in the context of Eraserhead. Mm-hmm. So what do we think? Is this a film that we would recommend to the viewing populace, or is this something that we're saying, well, you know, if you're watching all the David Lynch movies, I guess you should catch it. What do we think?
I mean, for the pure my interest in how people would experience this film, I want people to see it. I recommend that people watch this.
Yeah.
Because I do think it's an important film to have a conversation about.
Yeah. You know what? I would agree. I think whoever you are, not, you know, opened up in a, which I tried to do and failed, not opened up on your second screen on your desktop at work, having it playing while you're doing other work. No, that's not the way to watch Eraserhead. Clear out an evening for it. Mm-hmm. Try and take on Eraserhead. See what it does to you. Let it take you where it wants to take you. I would agree. Absolutely. I would say I would consider it a recommended film.
So here's one thing I'll say real quick about what you said. I found myself surprised by how quickly the film, I felt like the film went. It's an hour and a half, right? There are all these different images that kind of hit you in different ways. But I was like, whoa, that felt fast. And I don't really know what to make of that because it's not necessarily linear and there's all these different things going on. But I felt so drawn into it and the atmosphere that it was creating that I was lost in it. And like, oh, wow, okay, it's up, it's over.
Yeah, and I think, Jeff, you mentioned like when you first saw it, you were sort of trying to figure out whether or not, and I'm sorry if I mischaracterized, you're trying to figure out whether this was something that was boring you or if it was just to something or other. For me, am I like weirdly like all in with this, or is this just, I don't know, am I kind of bored? If I'm so bored, why am I not turning it off though? It's just it rides that odd line though, and to me that's part of the art of it. But I don't know, maybe I was the only one that experienced it that way, but I'm not sure.
That's a really good question, by the way. Would I recommend this film, especially after I kind of like just got done saying that it would be at the bottom of my DVD stack, even as I said that it's really important? Yes, I would recommend that film, even as I'm acutely aware that most people will probably hate me for the recommendation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Like, I mean, like, there are certainly other David Lynch films I would recommend first. This is a film that will either captivate people or literally, yeah, they'll come back to you and say, do you have an extra 120 minutes in your pocket? Because I would like to have that time back. I think it's an important film to see, but I think it's an important film to see in the context of what is the purpose of film? Like you kind of contextualize that. This idea that Lynch used to be a painter and he came to art through painting and he's expressing himself like a painter. And I was thinking a lot about that in the context of his recent work, Twin Peaks, The Return, just like how much television has room to grow as a medium for artists to enter into and treat the screen and sound and image as a painting, as something, as a thing of personal expression, but just narrative in general and the stories that they can bring to it to bring very personal things. And TV has grown by leaps and bounds as a result of artists bringing very personal things to the screen in recent years. But I think that movies could be even more Lynchian in that way, like an industry that can just support artists like making very personal things. I kind of, Eraserhead is just a very high like expression of that kind of notion.
Right.
But also not a film that was made by the industry, right?
It was
financed by AFI. I believe that Lynch owns this film outright. So it's not like 20th Century Fox is going to make a movie like this tomorrow, you know? Like, but I wish they would.
Yeah, definitely. Well, with that, I think that's it for this episode of The Freshman 15. Eraserhead, you're definitely going to see an intriguing film. I'm saying, Daniel's saying, I think Jeff is mostly saying, this is worth your time. Certainly, if you're the type of person to be listening to The Freshman 15 podcast, I think you're going to get something out of it. If you haven't seen Eraserhead before, take a chance, roll the dice, check it out.
Be haunted.
Why not?
So if you want to reach us, we have a Facebook page. We're on Instagram. You can also email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. We really do appreciate and enjoy hearing your thoughts, your opinions, your criticisms, whatever you have to give us. We want them. If you would take the time also on iTunes to rate us and our podcast, it helps so people can find us easily. So please go ahead and do that.
Daniel, question.
J-Bear.
How did you happen to see Eraserhead this most recent time or two?
So there's this awesome thing.
Yeah.
It's called Filmstruck.
Filmstruck, which has, among other fantastic films, Eraserhead. And not just Eraserhead, but the Criterion Edition, including all the extras.
Which is awesome.
Incredible. Only available on the streaming service Filmstruck. And not just Eraserhead. Some of the great filmmakers of all time. Filmmakers that you're not going to see on Netflix or Hulu or any of the other major streaming outlets. Do yourself a favor. If you're a film lover, in love with classic film, important film, film that really deserves to be seen and curated and shouldn't go away, consider a Filmstruck subscription. Daniel, you love it. I love it.
Love it.
Sign up today. Why not?
Yeah, why not?
We definitely want to thank our special guest today, Jeff Jensen. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
No, seriously, Jeff. Awesome.
Fantastic.
So great.
We really appreciate it. We really hope you'll be joining us again soon. If we can convince you, we would love to have you back very soon.
Yes.
Don't have to try too hard.
All right.
Let's do it.
Just keep the beer coming.
Right on. Well, whatever the case, that's it for this episode of The Freshman 15. Once again, I'm Jeremy Bear.
And I'm Daniel Long.
We'll see you soon.
Bye. Skid-a-doh, I said, skid-a-doh, bye. Skid-a-doh, I said, bye.